Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The works of Shakespeare have been adapted for centuries. Some adaptations modernize the archaic language or settings. More recent adaptations address social ills like racism and sexism. Catherine Vomero Santos is co-founder of the Borderlands Shakespeare Colectiva, a collection of academics, artists, and activists who adapt and study Shakespeare on La Frontera, on the border. Santos has penned Shakespeare in Tongues. The book doesn't so much examine the works of Shakespeare as it does use Shakespeare as a catalyst for exploring how others have used Shakespeare to explore colonialism, slavery, and the forced loss of language and culture. It explores adaptations inspired by Indian boarding schools, the recovery of a nearly lost indigenous language, Nepantla in Hamlet's most famous soliloquy, and the years-long Mexican-American studies ban in Arizona. Santos says this book grew out of the COVID-19 pandemic.
It was when I was working with the Borderlands Shakespeare Colectiva that I saw the power of studying Shakespeare's place in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. But during the pandemic, I was really craving connection. And once we were able to be vaccinated and move back out into the world, I wanted to experiment with putting myself in the places that I was studying. So the first trip that I took while I was writing this book was to a place called Friendship Park, which is located on the border between San Diego and Tijuana. And the reason I visited that park is because I was really interested in a poem called El Border Hamlet, or El Hamlet Fronterizo, by Guillermo Gómez Peña, which was first written in the 1980s when he was an active performance artist at this park, and rewritten in 2010 when it was no longer possible for his speaker to straddle the border.
Border State Park, facing the formidable Pacific Ocean with one foot on each country, I talk to my other self, a dos voces interiores. Me ama, no me ama. Me caso, no me caso. Me canso, no me canso.
Let's go ahead and talk about that Border Hamlet performance poem. It's part of one of the chapters in this book that explores sort of the border take on Hamlet's to be or not to be soliloquy, and the way that this poet and another poet, Brenda de Anda, approaches the poem is sort of through the lens of Gloria Anzaldúa's vision of Nepantla, which is people who grow up or are of the border. They straddle the two sides equally, just like how the narrator in the Hamlet border poem does. He begins the poem with one foot on one side of the border and one foot on the other side of the border. And so these two poets take that soliloquy by Hamlet and they again transform it into this vision of Nepantla. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So those two poems to me really spoke to each other in interesting ways. And Hamlet's to be or not to be soliloquy is often held up as this symbol of the universal human because it speaks to the dilemmas that many of us are contemplating as we're thinking about what it means to be alive, what it might mean after we die. But I think what these two poems show is that the poem isn't fully universal, but can be transformed to speak to a border experience and to speak to the ambivalence that a border subject faces, whether that ambivalence is about what country they're from, where they feel at home, what language they speak, what languages they speak, this idea of feeling neither from here nor there, but existing in this in-between space. And Gómez Peña is himself a migrant from Mexico who is sort of contemplating through this poem his irreversible process of Chicanoization.
Chicano, Mexicano, que soy o me imagino, regreso o continúo, me mato, no me mato, en México, in Califas, to write or to perform, en inglés, or in Spanish.
Whereas Iris de Anda's poem, To Be a Pocha or Not to Be, is about the child of immigrants who has inherited the intergenerational traumas of her parents and grandparents, but is nevertheless feeling caught between as somebody who is speaking English at school and speaking Spanish at home. So the To Be or Not to Be soliloquy becomes a way to contemplate that.
To be a pocha or not to be, because I'm not good enough for here or there. I hate to love my flag and hate to love my creation. Ashamed of Spanish in the first grade. I'm sorry, mommy, I never meant to hurt you. Ashamed of English in abuela's embrace. I know you never meant to hurt me.
But she comes to accept Nepantla as a place of self-acceptance, right? And she, by inserting the word pocha in to be or not to be, she's suggesting that she is a pocha or otherwise she doesn't exist.
And I have to correct myself. I called her Brenda de Anda. It's Iris de Anda. Brenda de Anda. I used to work with her for a while ago, not the poet. But again, going back to language, language is sort of the central theme to this book, Shakespeare in Tongues. And the first chapter of the book, it explores the robbing of a language, essentially, at Indian boarding schools, not just language, but the robbing of a culture. And can you explain sort of the ties to Shakespeare and to this tragedy that unfolded over a period of decades?
Yeah, so this chapter centers on an adaptation of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure by a Choctaw playwright named Randy Reinholds, who's the founding director of Native Voices at the Autry out in Los Angeles. And Reinholds uses Shakespeare's problem comedy, that is a play that doesn't have an easy resolution, even though it's categorized as a comedy, to really shine a light on this understudied part of American history, where the U.S. federal government engaged in the systematic dispossession of both land and language by removing children from their homes and forcibly assimilating them. And Reinholds chose to situate his adaptation of Measure for Measure at a very real school in Genoa, Nebraska. And I actually traveled to that school as part of my research because now it is a museum and cultural center that is part of an active attempt on the part of the settlers in that town of Genoa to engage in a form of reconciliation that begins with truth. So his play is both set in this place and exploring that history. But what I think is really important for us to acknowledge is not just that this happened, but that Shakespeare's works played a role in the curriculum of these schools. There is archival evidence in the newspapers and in other documents from these boarding schools that the students were learning Shakespeare. So for a native playwright to be adapting a Shakespeare play is a really active reclamation of the same tools that were used to colonize native children and to strip their languages from them.
And you have in the book actually a photo of this cast of native children actors who are doing a production of Shakespeare. And apparently this was praised by many of the officials who saw this as a sign of that assimilation that they were after.
Yeah, and that photograph is from a very particular moment, which was the 1916 tercentenary of Shakespeare's death, where there were celebrations all over the country and all over the world. And so at the Carlisle Indian Boarding School, which was the first federal Indian boarding school and seen as a kind of model for the rest of the system, the children were acting in a Shakespearean pageant. And the media coverage of this event was anti-Indigenous in all kinds of ways, but showed that the assimilationist agenda of the school was, quote-unquote, successful, according to the people who wanted to see it as such.
Catherine Vomero Santos is Associate Professor of English at Trinity University in San Antonio. She's the co-founder of the Borderlands Shakespeare Colectiva and is the author of Shakespeare in Tongues. When we come back, an almost extinct indigenous language is incorporated into an adaptation of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale.
That story is one in which a family is broken and separated through a kind of tragedy, but through the careful protection across time, that baby is found once more, quite like the language of the Santinas Band of Chumash Indians.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
If you have land or real estate you no longer use, consider donating it to TPR. Whether it's a cabin you've outgrown or a lot that's just sitting empty, your property can become a powerful gift that supports the programming you love. It's easy to start, and your donation may bring valuable tax benefits. Learn more about donating your real estate by calling 844-277-HOME or visit tpr.careasy.org/real-estate-donation.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The English language is often called the language of Shakespeare. European colonial occupation across the Americas has resulted in the loss of native languages in the favor of English, recently designated the official language of the U.S. A majority of native languages have become extinct since explorers and settlers stepped foot in North America. Native speakers and researchers have attempted to resurrect some of these languages. In one case in California, researchers studied a lost indigenous language for years, but their work sat unseen and unstudied afterwards for decades. Catherine Vomero Santos is the author of Shakespeare in Tongues. She explains how this language was revitalized and even incorporated into an adaptation of a Shakespearean tale.
So the language is the Somala language of the Santinas Band of Chumash Indians in the central coast of California. And as you mentioned, the story is really remarkable. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, a researcher named John P. Harrington was working for the Smithsonian to record as many speakers of dying indigenous languages as he could. But nothing was done with the thousands, if not millions, of pages of notes that he took and the recordings that he created. They were just put on shelves. In some cases, they were stored in chicken coops. It wasn't until a dissertation student at the University of California, Berkeley, was assigned to start organizing these notes that a grammar for this language was developed. Now, this researcher, Richard Applegate, didn't think that anyone would be interested in the language, so he too put his dissertation on the shelf. But a few decades later, the tribe contacted him and said, "We would like to work to revitalize our language." And so they began working together to bring this language back to life and to begin educating the children. And it was not that long after the tribe began this work that Jose Cruz Gonzalez, who I know has been on your program with me, set out to create an adaptation of The Winter's Tale set in the central coast of California. And what I find so remarkable about that story of incorporating the Somala language into his production is that it maps onto the plot of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale in really remarkable ways, because that story is one in which a family is broken and separated through a kind of tragedy, but through the careful protection across time, that baby is found once more, quite like the language of the Santinas Band of Chumash Indians. It is set both in the 21st century and in the 19th century. And so there's a young couple who falls back in time and they witness the events that lead up to the U.S. invasion of Mexico and the ultimate redrawing of the border in 1848 as we know it today. And what the play helps to demonstrate is that the girl at the center of the story, her name is Allie, she discovers her indigenous roots, and she is able to understand that her experiences in the 20th century are deeply connected to what was happening in the 19th century and, of course, before, and that time is not linear. Time is actually quite circular, and that, you know, the rupture created by the border ends up being an opportunity for her to reconnect with that past and to discover the roots of her own identity.
The chapter that I thought was really interesting, and one that I think puts people's minds into what we're observing in the culture wars today, is the chapter entitled "What's Past is Prologue." And it has to do with the Mexican-American studies ban in Arizona. It all began apparently in 2006 when Dolores Huerta, a very famous farm worker advocate who worked alongside Cesar Chavez, she made a speech, and one of the statements she made in that speech at an Arizona high school was, you know, I'm paraphrasing, why do Republicans hate Mexican Americans? And that just erupted into what became a years-long court battle in fighting the Mexican-American Studies book ban, and the group of Libro Traficantes who are fighting that ban. We've talked about that before on this program with Tony Diaz, the leader of the Libro Traficantes, who are doing book smuggling of these books that were no longer part of the MOS curriculum, getting them into the hands of students. And so talk about how that ties sort of into this overall theme of Shakespeare.
Yeah, it seems like an unexpected connection.
Yeah.
But the day that the teachers in that MOS program were meeting with their administrators to determine what they could and could not teach in the wake of a law that effectively prohibited their curriculum, Curtis Acosta, who was teaching Chicano literature, was actually scheduled to teach Shakespeare's The Tempest that day. And the reason he had put The Tempest on his syllabus was because he wanted his students to understand that their concerns about language, assimilation, and identity had much deeper roots, and that writers from other cultures were thinking about this. So the figure of Caliban in Shakespeare's The Tempest became this emblem of resilience and resistance and claims to both land and identity that really resonated with his students. What he wisely understood was that even that play wouldn't be safe under this law, because there was no way that students wouldn't talk about issues of race that they were undoubtedly going to see in Shakespeare's The Tempest. And so when news of books being packed up in front of students in their classrooms, you know, made headlines worldwide, Shakespeare's The Tempest was front and center. And in many ways, that was sort of beside the point, right? It mattered more that Sandra Cisneros was being banned. But people, of course, were obsessed with the absurdity of banning Shakespeare. And I think that that's right. In some ways, it is absurd. But in other ways, what the media wasn't paying attention to were the ways in which The Tempest is also a play about epistemic domination, about assimilation, and about a character named Prospero who is very possessive of books. And so the way that I read the play through the lens of the MOS controversy is to kind of pull out those resonances and to lean on a line from The Tempest in which one of the characters says, what's past is prologue, and to read what's happening in that play as a way of understanding these kinds of cycles of epistemic domination that we see across time. And I say, you know, in the book, it's not so much that Shakespeare is universal, it's that these patterns of colonial violence are unfortunately recurring. And I think we're seeing that increasingly so today.
Well, reading a little bit about the character of Caliban, there are people who probably, like myself, are not familiar with that character. But reading, again, about him, he is an indigenous character on this island on which Prospero lives, and he is dominated by this one character, and he is definitely with no subtlety at all. He is a marginalized character.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, and you know, Caliban has a long history of being recognized in this way as a character who speaks back to the colonizer. Prospero and his daughter Miranda claim to have educated Caliban and have given him language. And he says, you taught me language, and my profit on it is that I can curse you. And that has become a kind of rallying cry for people in situations where they too have been dominated in similar ways. So some of the earliest writings about Caliban in this way emerge from the Caribbean, and he's been adopted by figures in Latin America as a kind of symbol for the mestizo and the symbol of resistance. And so it makes sense that Caliban would be part of this MOS curriculum, and he would become a character that students would be interested in thinking with and thinking through.
Well, tell us a little bit about how your view of Shakespeare and sort of this deconstructing colonialism through his works, how it all sort of plays into the Borderland Shakespeare Collectiva that was founded here in San Antonio. How is all of this developing, especially in the wake of what we've just been talking about what's past as prologue, what we've seen in the past in Tucson, we are seeing it taking place now. You are seeing universities with a lot of their ethnic studies courses being pulled back or canceled altogether. I mean, how is this sort of playing into what you have written about and what you're working with the Shakespeare Borderlands Collectiva?
Yeah, so this project, as I mentioned at the outset, really grows out of my collaborations with Catherine Gillen and Adriana Santos at Texas A&M San Antonio. And part of our work has been to edit and make available works of Borderland Shakespeare. But as scholars, we feel that it's incredibly important to study these works in detail and to, more importantly, study the ways in which Shakespeare intersects with the histories, cultures, and languages of the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. So part of my methodology in this book is not so much to study Shakespeare, but to use Shakespeare as a spotlight on these histories that are largely obscured. I think for people in this region, they might be less obscured than they are on a national and international basis. But I've been very interested in how following Shakespeare to a place can really open up conversations, because Shakespeare does carry enormous cultural capital, and that's something that our project recognizes. But it also recognizes that there's a long history of adapting, translating, remaking Shakespeare in this region with the tools, languages, and worldviews that we know make this region so vibrant.
Well, Catherine, is there anything that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about during this conversation?
Sure. I'd like to give a quick shout out to my cover artist, whose name is Fausto Fernandez, and he's from Juarez, El Paso. The cover image that I chose for this book is titled Highlights of the Flawed and Imperfect. And I just love the sentiment of that title, but I wanted to highlight his incredible work. And for listeners throughout the borderlands, his work is in several museums, including the McNay here in San Antonio. So check out Fausto's work.
Well, Catherine Romero Santos, thank you so much for talking to us today on Fronteras.
Thank you so much for having me, Norma.
Catherine Romero Santos is Associate Professor of English at Trinity University in San Antonio. She's the co-founder of the Borderlands Shakespeare Collectiva and is the author of Shakespeare in Tongues. The book is part of the series Spotlight on Shakespeare that explores how contemporary movements shed new light on Shakespeare's work. Some other titles in the series are Shakespeare in the Age of Mass Incarceration, Shakespeare Through Islamic Worlds, and Shakespeare and Queer Representation. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.